Properly.
Call to order the House Committee on Human Services and Women's Wellness. Please turn off your cell phones, blackberries, blueberries, any other berries that you've got. And it's not enough just to put them on silence or whatever. You've got to turn them completely off or else they affect the equipment. So we are opening the public hearing on House Bill 3617. Do we have a list of people who want to speak? We weren't able to hear everybody yesterday who was here to speak, and so we're continuing that list. If anyone has not been able to sign on the list yet and they would like to, we'll have another one over there. Thank you. Representative Gelster suggested that we go over the amendments. Hopefully everybody's gotten them. They would be available over here, wouldn't they, if people don't have them yet? These are amendments that we got yesterday. Amend this bill. Representative?
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's the amendments that we got yesterday, and if you'll remember those, changed the title of the database. It would be called a Database of Quality Care Violations. And it also made more clear the narrowness of the bill to apply in the database portion to facilities serving individuals with developmental disabilities. There's another set of amendments that many of you were part of developing yesterday because we all finished those conversations around 5 o'clock. We don't have them yet. We will get them sometime today, and we'll get them to you as soon as we have them. But they do the following things. They will put language in the bill that prohibits the department from using identifying information such as social security numbers, birth dates, or addresses of folks in the database. It will make the adjustments that the department talked about yesterday in terms of making sure that mental health is pulled out of the quality care fund. It has the amendment that addresses the issue in Multnomah and Clackamas County, where the licensing fees are done by the county and operated there through a waiver. It removes the words about the circuit court in the portion about how to take your name off of the list. That came at the request of the unions and the circuit court. And the other part is that there's a change in the structure of the fee schedule for the assisted living facilities, RCFs, and nursing homes on the senior and physical disability side, which lowers the rate for those smaller homes in that kind of 0 to 16 bed range. And some of you were part of those discussions to develop that yesterday also. So those changes should be available for you a little later today.
Great. Thank you, Representative Gelster. Does anyone have any questions about the amendments before we proceed?
Thank you. There's one more that's very important.
Go.
This is the difficulty of not having them right here. The other...
My copy, do you want?
Well, we don't. These are the ones that are coming this afternoon.
Okay.
I would love it if you had a copy of them. But the other one is that there was a conflict, which we discussed yesterday. The bill has that $2,500 statutory minimum fine for the egregious violations that result in a death or a rape. And the problem with that is that in law, there's a $6,000 cap over a certain period of time, and that would quickly lead up to that. It was important to the providers that we leave some protection in the bill to have those daily and quarterly maximums of penalties, but we did make the adjustment that the $2,500, if there was a death or a rape, would not count towards that cap. So that gets pulled out of that cap, and that will be in the new amendments today.
And we hope to get these by this afternoon, and we'll pass them out to everybody on the committee. And will there be ones available then for the public also?
Yeah, Chair, what I will do is when I get a copy from of them, I'll scan them in and just put them on the gov delivery. So if you're getting the agendas for this committee already, look for that. We'll have some paper copies in 4:53. You might want to wait till later in the day, 3, 4 o'clock, for those if you want paper. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, I have a list of people to speak, and as I said, feel free to add yourselves to the list if you're so inclined. Lauren Rhodes.
Is Lauren here?
Is Ruth Gaius here?
She couldn't come back down.
Do you want to speak for her? Do you think you can, Holly? Can you speak for her?
I'll listen to Lauren, Carrie.
Okay. Okay, Lauren, whenever.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lauren Rhodes with the Oregon Healthcare Association, and I'd like to take an opportunity to thank Representative Gelser for working very closely with us on the small portion of this bill that applies to our membership. There is a very good provision within this bill that actually our members are highly supportive of, and that is the creation of the Quality Care Fund and keeping those dollars that come into the state from fees and fines directed at nursing facilities and assisted living and residential care facilities, keeping those within the Quality Care Fund so that providers and staff can become better trained and in better compliance with state regulations through the use of those dollars in programs that the state targets at that quality care improvement model. So we're highly supportive of that, and connected to that is an increase in the license fees, and we are supportive of those pending what we see in the amendments this afternoon. But we did support an increase in those fees in order to maintain them in the Quality Care Fund. So that was a provision that we highly support. Secondly, we also supported the maintaining of the protection in statute for the civil monetary penalties, with the exception of those spelled out incidences that Representative Gelser mentioned earlier related to the $2,500 increase. We have a public policy committee meeting today with our members, and we will recommend that they support the concepts included within this bill and that we can continue to support the bill as it moves along. So I'm happy to take any questions. And
thank you, Lauren.
Okay.
Any questions of Lauren?
No, you did not.
Thank you so much. Ozzie, it's good to see you.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Ozzie Rose with the Alliance, and we also support the bill. Our interest is in the fees, the quality care specifically. We need to help our workforce be a better, highly qualified workforce, and this is one of the steps to make that happen. And our my exec talked with our people yesterday, and we are supportive of the bill, pending seeing exactly how it looks.
A little fallen. Okay. Any questions of Ozzie? Thank you both so much. Okay. Art Towers. Bob, if you want to come at the same time, please.
Members of the committee, Chair Tomei, my name is Arthur Towers, Political Director for Service Employees in Local 503. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Normally, I like to provide brief testimony for the sake of everybody involved, including myself, but I want to go on a bit longer today because this is such an important issue. I want to be clear, we represent nearly 20,000 care providers in a variety of settings, and in terms of this population of clients, we represent adult foster care providers, as well as some providers in the not-for-profit community as well. Over the course of the past several years, we have really fought hard to stand up for quality. Our members in home care for the elderly and disabled have really stepped up and been very present in the Capitol and partnered with many of you to improve the quality of care there. In their first contract negotiations, they gave up $5 million in wage increases in order to set that money aside for pay training to improve the quality of care. On the nursing home front, where we represent nearly 1,000 providers, we fought hard, along with many of you, along with responsible nursing home operators, to improve the quality of care and improve staffing levels in nursing homes. Our child care providers have helped, again, with the leadership of many members on this committee, have improved the quality of care there by moving Oregon from a 49th in the country to a top-tier state in terms of affordability and accessibility of child care. And so I want to be clear, we're very proud to stand for quality. It's really a privilege to work with members who make that such a high priority, not just fighting for themselves, but fighting for their clients as well. So I really thank the committee for moving this committee bill forward on such an important topic. And this is the, you know, fighting for quality is the sort of thing that we love to support. And we love to support this bill and improve this bill as we move forward. This bill zeroes in on consumer education, and we think that there needs to be equal portions of consumer education and quality improvement. That's why our top priority this session is to improve funding through the Ways and Means process for the quality of care and training for care providers for the developmentally disabled, specifically adult foster care providers. And so that's our top priority this session, but this bill is also important to us. So, in terms of this legislation in particular, we think that the bill's on the right track, the goals are worthy. We think that there's a lot of things that can be done to improve the legislation, hoping that between now and February 29th we can get a lot of those improvements made. We feel that we need to do whatever we can to provide incentives to recruitment and retention and training. So we feel that when it comes to quality, which is what I think that we're all really fighting for here, that that's what we need to provide incentives for. One example of how the bill could be improved to address, to provide an incentive for training is if on the database we listed remedies as well as quality care violations, so that if someone drops somebody, let's say, that that's listed and clearly stated as to what it is, but then it's also listed that that care provider put in 8 hours worth of training to understand and learn exactly how to lift the client. We think that that sort of approach will give care providers and their employers in the nonprofit setting the incentive to really improve the quality of care. Because remember who we're talking about here. Many of these care providers are, you know, 20-something young people who have it in their heart to care for vulnerable Oregonians. And, you know, for them to be stigmatized, for better or for worse, and we have a disagreement among friends about how bad the stigma is, but for them to be stigmatized when they're trying to do the right thing and, you know, follow their hearts instead of their pocketbooks is not a good thing. And, you know, I understand that this information is already readily available. I understand that this information is already public record. But, you know, putting it on the Internet in this day and age is a different matter. So it's a quick step from the state database to MySpace. And so these are the sorts of things that I just want to be cautious about as the bill moves forward. In conversations with allies on this and with legislators, we've talked about the idea of providing clarity about an issue resolution process around this. And we know that that may have a fiscal impact. We don't want to, like, mess up the bill. We don't want to go there if we don't have to. And know that for union members, there will be an issue resolution process of one kind or another. Maybe it impacts placement on this public database, and maybe it doesn't. But again, for union members, we'll have some sort of issue resolution process, but, you know, we need it for every care provider. Okay? We're concerned about how these things are listed, and the committee's done well in terms of moving forward amendments to change the name of the database. We feel that the substantiated complaints of abuse has a different carries a different connotation than what one might think of it as, because as it currently stands, the due process on that piece of it is short of what we would see as a standard. So changing that phrase to preliminary findings of abuse will get across the same concept, I think, you know, that there's been a preliminary finding that James Jones dropped somebody. you know, and then the James Jones went through 8 hours of training to address the situation, is, I think, a step in the right direction. I think that those are really the big points I want to raise, you know, in today's hearing. You know, we're concerned about making sure that we think this all the way through, concerned about the potential that state funds would be going to litigation rather than to quality improvements, training improvements. And, you know, I feel like I've, in today's testimony, that I've damned the bill with faint praise, and that's not my intention, because I really feel that the consumer education piece of this is really important, too. The quality care fund piece of this is very important, too. I don't want to diminish consumers, clients, guardians, family members' access to information. You know, much of this is already in the newspaper. There's private firms that want to come forth and privatize the service and get it up on the web anyways. I understand all that. But I just wanted us to be cautious and thoughtful as we're moving forward to make public policy. And I think that the work the committee's done prior to the session, the work the committee's done in moving this forward is great and totally on the right track. And I just hope we spend the next 3 weeks working as hard as you all have worked to get it done. I regret that we didn't have the capacity to be as engaged as we probably should have been prior to the session. But I do really feel like, again, that we can be helpful here down the road over the course of the next few weeks, improving the bill and then thereafter in the implementation. So thank you very much for the opportunity to testify, and thanks, Chair Tomei, for letting me go on longer than I'd like to.
You're welcome, Arthur.
I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Arthur, I just want to point out, I mean, you mentioned February 29th. Actually, the timeline is much, much shorter than that. That's when we're going to be out of here. So when we're talking about working this bill, we're not talking about weeks, we're talking about hours. So what we can do is somewhat limited. So yeah, I just want you to be aware of that. I mean, you've mentioned that a couple of times, but we don't have until February 29th.
Chair Tomei, I'm a chair of the Committee on Wishful Thinking. And, but the bottom line is that I think I really appreciate the difficult dilemma that you're in as we work through a new circumstance for all of us involved. This is a very difficult way to make quality public policy. I think I'm a big supporter that we're going forward with this effort to consider new legislation, but I do recognize the hardships that y'all are facing in terms of producing quality legislation on this timeline.
Right. Question. Thank you, Arthur. Any questions? Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I need to get a little clarity in my mind in terms of your concerns, and I'm hoping that you've had an opportunity to review the amendments that we got yesterday, and not the mysterious ones that we don't have yet. I was particularly taken when I looked at the changes in terms of the definition of abuse that will go into Section 2, I think it is. And then I'm thinking about the examples that accidentally allowing someone to fall. I don't really want to say dropping, but and the remedies, the training, and that kind of thing. But the definition of abuse as relates to this bill and the database that we're talking about are very limited and specific, and they talk about physical injury that's caused by other than accidental means that appears to be at variance with the explanation given for the injury, and willful infliction of physical pain or injury, things like that. I guess when I look at this list of what's going to be included in the definition of abuse, I don't see where accidentally allowing someone to slip or that kind of an occurrence that might happen would qualify, I guess, for this list of abuse. And I'm just wondering if you've had a chance to look at that and what your thoughts are.
Chair Tomei, Representative Cowan, thanks for the thoughtful question. I have had a chance to look at it. I'm still nervous about that. I haven't really seen, I still feel like under either that section or the amendment I'm looking at is the dash twos, line 12. You know, some of this stuff might be covered under the neglect piece. And I think that the intention of the committee in terms of drafting the legislation, if I understand it correctly, is that we want to capture those things in case a pattern is formed, so that if there's an accidental letting somebody fall, but it happens 5 days a week.
Okay, that's where the remedy and the additional training that you're interested in would fall into.
That's correct. I mean,
okay, I understand.
Any other questions? Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for testifying, Arthur. I have a question, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but what has your experience been with your members in the investigation process with the department? How adequate do you think it is? What would you suggest in terms of either rule changes or directives from us to the department to have greater consistency if that's an issue? I'm just curious.
Chair Tomei, Representative Kotek, with the population that we're talking about today, the adult foster care providers, we're very new to this. These members just joined the union in the last 4 or 5 months, so I'm not ready or qualified to comment on that, which is technical words for I have no idea. But in terms of home care, we do have experience in the in-home care for the elderly and disabled. And in that setting, it's been very interesting to go through the process there. And I just want to be clear about this. In the course of the in-home care program, where there's been efforts to rescind people's provider numbers, i.e. their opportunity to provide care to Medicaid clients, we've really only had one disagreement with the state. We won that case, but again, over the course of the 5 or 6 years, there's really been only one case about blocking or keeping somebody that the state felt was bad, that we felt that the charges weren't justified. We've only had one of those, to the best of my knowledge. But in most of the other cases, we've agreed. We wanted to make sure the person had a hearing, had a chance to be represented, had a chance to talk through the process. But at the end of the day, I believe in the last 5 years that there's only been one such case. I'll double check that, but I'm 99% sure. And if it's different, I'll definitely get back to you. But we've only had one of those cases in the last 5 years in home care.
Thank you. Good.
Thank you. Any other questions at this witness? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank you, Arthur, for all of your participation with the committee and efforts to improve this and talk out the issues that are around it, and how much I appreciate your ongoing advocacy for the people that the folks that you represent serve. I think SEIU has a tremendous record of standing up for this population of folks, and I just want you to know how much I appreciate that.
Chair Tomei, Representative Gelser, right back at you. Thank you.
Bob.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bob Juneff. I'm the director of Oregon Advocacy Center in Portland. And we are a federally funded agency, nonprofit, that provides legal advocacy services to people with disabilities. Part of our charge under both federal and state law is to receive and investigate allegations of abuse or neglect of people with disabilities, and that includes people with developmental disabilities. And so this is an area that we have a great deal of familiarity with. First of all, I want to thank the committee for bringing this bill forward. And the remarks I'm going to make, I just want to say that all of the partners that you've heard in testimony and all the partners that have been working on making this a better bill are all needed in order to improve conditions for folks with disabilities in the community, and I really want to thank them and honor them in terms of their willingness to come to the table and do that work. That having been said, as you might imagine, given the nature of my work, that I believe the present situation that we have now in Oregon is intolerable. The conditions that were revealed in the Oregonian articles I think is an embarrassment to us all, because I don't think there's anyone in this room who condones abuse, who wants to see abuse, who in any way wants to defend abuse. But it's something that's somehow has gotten away from us, and that we need to start to try to grapple with and move in a better direction. That's why, as I come here today, I'm very glad that you're meeting, because I do believe this is an emergency situation, and I think it's something that we need to start addressing right now. And I believe that a good first step is to bring some more transparency to the system, so that people who use and rely upon our services can have some sense that they're getting something good. And I think that market principles, if you will, and what I mean by that is that a person can actually shop for services that they want and need and evaluate different services and make a reasonable decision about where's a good place for my loved one to go, is absolutely an essential part of that. And that means that people who are consumers need knowledge and they need some background data to make a good decision. I deal with many families who run into situations in which their loved ones have been abused, and they come to us for assistance and recommendations. It's very difficult to say to them, well, this may have been a situation where an employer decided not to ask about the person's background because they were afraid that if they did ask about the prospective employee's background, that somehow they would have legal liability. It's very difficult for me to say to them that former employers didn't share information about experiences they had with that person in their employment because they were afraid of giving that information out to the next employer for fear of legal liability. That is a situation that families don't want to hear, and it is so ironic in that somehow in fearing liability that people would not find out about a person's past having to do with abuse. This registry is the wrong word, but this allowing more information to be shared can address that, because individuals who want to use the service can go get the information themselves and make decisions for themselves. And that puts the consumer more in the driver's seat, which is where they need to be. I wanted to address something that Representative Cowan said, because I think it's very important. When we talk about abuse, we talk about abuse under the state law, and the definition of abuse is very narrow, where the definition talks about death, serious injury, sexual abuse. And these are very serious and narrow definitions, and a finding of substantiated abuse is a very serious matter. Again, if I was a family member, and we were talking about a matter of that severity, I would not be comforted to know that, well, perhaps this is something that would be taken care of elsewhere and you don't need to know about it. I think it's something they would want to know. I'm going to give you an example. And this came out of the Attorney General's Task Force on Sexual Abuse. It's a statistic, it's a national statistic, but it's applicable to Oregon. This just gives you a sense of the vulnerability of the people we're talking about here. According to three studies, 83% of females with developmental disabilities and 32% of males with disabilities have been victims of sexual assault. 79% of those victims have been victimized more than once. 49% have been victimized 10 or more times. And in these cases, 95 to 99% of the offenders were known to the victim, as the people who were close to that person. Now, I'm not bringing this statistic to you to say that this is the result of bad workers. I'm bringing it to you to just as an example of the fact that we're talking about a highly vulnerable population. These are people who find it difficult to report. They may come up with severe bruises and injuries. They can't tell people what happened. They're alone with others, maybe caregivers. And the only way that you can even tell that something has happened oftentimes is just by whatever physical evidence that might be available. And I tell this to you because what it means is that we have to be extra vigilant to address the vulnerability of these folks. We can't rely upon them to report. We have to take that extra step. And so, yes, I think it's very important for workers to have due process and to have good training and good supports. But when there is a questionable call about this type of injury and that type, when you have a person with that level of vulnerability, I would suggest to you that it only makes common sense that you have to be cautious. And the idea, again, from a family member, that if my child came up with a very serious injury, and there was a worker present and there was no explanation for it, that it would be reasonable to be very cautious in that situation and not say, well, we can't prove it, so we'll just kind of let it go. I bring these to you just to highlight that these are special situations and they need special care. House Bill 3617 takes, I believe, a very small step in the right direction. We need to do more. I believe that we need to have that people who work with vulnerable populations, that those individuals need to be registered. There needs to be a state registry for them. They need to have a certification. They need to have the minimal training. If they do, then if there's complaints, they will have due process through the maintenance of their registration. That costs some money. And it's something that I think we need to talk more about so that it may be a solution for us ultimately whereby we can assure that workers have required training, certification, and that if there are problems that they have an opportunity to challenge complaints through a process that's fair. But for now, I believe that giving information to consumers is a good step. I think we need to take it. And I really hope that you do, because I think in light of what we've seen in the Oregonian, that this body needs to take some action to address the problems we have.
Thank you, Bob. Any questions of Mr. Jundiff? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bob, as you describe and use the term cautious, where you want to go in determining, I would imagine you're actually alluding to the idea and the concept of determining what substantiated abuse is. What standard do you feel best applies with what you've just described of death, serious injury, sex abuse, assault?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, a standard in terms of making a decision whether it's occurred or not?
That's right.
Well, right now in our system, we have a mandatory abuse reporting and investigation system, and that really is designed to, what I would say, it's an information gathering process. And so the Office of Information and Training, or a local county, is mandated to find information and compile it and see if it meets by preponderance the definitions they have. That information then gets sent on if there's a finding, a substantiated finding of abuse, to licensing agencies if the perpetrator or the facility is licensed, or to an employer. Once it gets to that entity, then it's really up to that entity to decide how to use the information. And so, for example, if a licensing agency were to say, gee, this is so serious that we think it affects the license of the facility or the professional, then it has different standards in terms of taking action. So if it's going to affect a person's employment, for example, the employer has that information. The very fact that there's been substantiated abuse doesn't, in my estimation, isn't definitive of anything. It doesn't decide anything. The employer has to meet whatever standard an employer would normally have to meet in order to take some job action or disciplinary action against that employee. The information that comes from them from the Office of Information and Training is just information they can use for that purpose. I think that oftentimes in the discussion we have, and if I lose you, please.
You understand.
I have trouble explaining this sometimes, so thank you. Mm-hmm. Is that sometimes there's confusion because in terms of what this system does right now, there's a feeling that it's sort of a court of law and that it's making it, that the Office of Information and Training is making a decision that now has some definite effect upon an employee. And that isn't the case. The way we've built it is that there's a two-stage process. It may be. Many states do have something more like a situation in which a state office makes a decision and that decision actually has direct impact upon employment status or licensing status. That isn't the case in Oregon right now. It's something we might want to investigate doing, but right now it doesn't. There is stigma attached to it, if you will, which is, I think, what you're hearing in some of the testimony, is that, gee, you know, once a person's found to have been an abuser, now that label sticks to them, and an employer may take an action based upon that label, or may not. A licensing agency may. But as an attorney who works in this area, I can tell you that, at least in my estimation, it doesn't have a definitive impact like that. It's just information that comes to the employer. That employer may react. It's up to the employer as to how to react to that information.
Can I follow up?
Well, very
okay,
quickly.
Thank you.
Anybody else is going to be asking Mr. Joondeff anything? Okay, we'll move along because we've got other people to
say. You know that there's basically, I mean, generally three different levels, I mean, standards that are used in civil as well as in criminal, mm-hmm. preponderance of evidence, clear and convincing, and then also you have beyond reasonable doubt. What would, of those three, as being used as a standard, I guess is reasonable belief too, which I've heard some definition of, which bothers me to no end, erring on the side of the client. How can we get there with one of those three to the point where it's very protective of the client, but then also of the facility?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, I'll speak to you as an employer. As the director of the Advocacy Center, I have about 30 employees, and our employees have to work with vulnerable populations, and so I have to be alert to the fact if there's any problem with our employees that might create liability for our organization, but also in potentially hurt the people who we're supposed to serve, and so I have to be very alert to that. A decision that I make in terms of a deployment of an individual to be with vulnerable people may be a different decision that I make in terms of discipline of an employee. And so I would want to have information about someone if there was a suspicion that they may not be safe to be with our clients. And I may make a decision based upon that I don't want that employee, if I had suspicions, even if they weren't confirmed, I might not want that employee to be left alone with a vulnerable person. But that's going to be different than my decision about termination or discipline based upon the relationship that we have with our employees. So, I hope this is, I don't think that there's a single standard for a particular use, is what I'm suggesting. And so right now, the way we have it set up, when the Office of Information and Training makes a determination based upon preponderance, I think that's appropriate because the purpose of that activity is to gather information to protect people. how an employer makes a decision about how to address the employment relationship with that employee, I think, is a different question and raises a different standard. And I truly believe that an employee should have full due process rights in terms of any employment action that is taken. It's only fair. And we're not going to have a good workforce. I mean, ultimately, and I agree completely that these are folks, the vast majority of folks who go into this work, they don't do it to make become rich. They do it because their heart is in the right place and they're very caring people and they want to do the right thing. But human nature being what it is, sometimes that isn't the case, and so there needs to be a good, effective way to get to the bottom of it. That having been said, I think the question that you raise is that, well, gee, what type of information should a consumer have? Should a consumer only have information about employees who have been proven to have done something wrong? Or should consumers just have general information about what are the types of complaints that have issued from a facility, what types of response has there been, and so forth? If I were a consumer, for example, and I had heard that, there was a facility in which two or three times somebody had not given change back to somebody for a soda, I don't think that would be a big one for me. And I think that if I talked to an administrator facility about things that I'd seen on about problems at the facility, and they said, yeah, this is part of running this kind of work, and we are on top of it, and we respond to it, and this is what we do, that's what I would want to hear. I want to hear of a facility that wants to get information about what's going on, gets it, and responds appropriately to it. I wouldn't want to hear, gee, there's no problems here, or gee, we just fire everybody. That we have to trust the consumer at some point to make decisions based upon good information. And that's what we think this would encourage.
Chair Tomei, Vice Chair Olson, do you want to just chime in on that question for just one?
Very briefly.
Very briefly. We want to be sure that this legislation and statute provides clear delineation between the types of offenses that we're talking about here, because not giving change back should be treated differently somehow on the database, on the Internet, than the severe types of abuse that Mr. Jindeff referred to. Also, we are concerned about removal from the list, the remedy piece, if that data is in the database, helps. And we're also concerned about the other type of neglect that Representative Cowan raised, because we feel that a lot of neglect in these facilities is due to short staffing. And so it might be I was neglectful of a patient's needs, but that's because I had too many patients to deal with at one time, but that still will come back on me on the Internet. So I feel like there's a lot of improvement to be made in this bill in the next few hours or the next few weeks.
Thank you, Arthur.
Okay,
Representative Gotek.
I'll pass. Thank you.
Okay, all right. Good. Any other questions of either of these students? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we have somebody who's come from more than 100 miles away. That's Marcy Ingledew. She comes from Josephine County, and she's a parent, and she's in the Arc of Oregon. Is that right, Marcy?
Yes. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I do live in Grants Pass, Oregon, but I also work in Salem, so even though I do commute, it's not on a daily basis, so I just want to put that out there.
All right, Marcy.
I can relate to the commute.
Oh, yeah. But I appreciate this opportunity, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Marcy Ingledew, and I'm a parent of a 16-year-old son with developmental disabilities, as well as being the executive director for the Arc of Oregon. I live in Grants Pass, and I raise my children there along with my husband. Always as a parent, but also as a professional in the field, I'm here to express our support for House Bill 3617, and it is an honor and privilege to have the opportunity to speak before you today. And when the Oregonian reported these stories months ago, unfortunately, as a parent and as a professional, the Arc of Oregon was not surprised at the information that was given out to the public. We did hope, however, at that time, that the general public would become a little bit more aware of the situations that we continually address. Today, we're thankful that you as legislators have seen those reports, listened to those, and have started to take action. We applaud your speed at your ability to look at the situation. However, House Bill 3617 is truly only the first step of many activities that we must really put in place to address the safety and well-being for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. For over 50 years, the Arc of Oregon has worked to address this situation in a variety of different areas in our advocacy work. We provide guardianship and advocacy services to over 100 individuals statewide. We receive many, many qualified referrals that we could accept. However, due to limited funding, we only end up accepting the ones that have the most horrific abusive and neglective cases. And this continues to go on a week-to-week basis for us. In addition, as Mr. Jundev talked about, the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force, we participate in that, and we have alarming statistics that I've provided for you in my written testimony. It's amazing to me, particularly as a parent, to think that 90% of individuals with developmental disabilities will experience sexual abuse at some point in their lives. The fact that 95 to 99% of the offenders of sexual violence are people that those individuals know. These are individuals that are trusted, that work, that provide care. Some of these individuals are even families. We really think that it's imperative that you move this bill forward. We cannot wait until the next session. We have waited too long already. Although employers, we understand, are concerned with the liability issues regarding the establishment of the database, I respectfully remind you that our first priority must be to the individuals with developmental disabilities. And I'm confident, after hearing yesterday's testimony, that concerns raised will certainly address those concerns once we pass this bill. As a parent of a 16-year-old son with developmental disabilities, I have worked hard for 16 years to raise my son to be independent, to become a member of society. But there's always that nagging feeling in the pit of my stomach. Will my son become one of those statistics? Will I be sorry that I advocated for his inclusion? Will I not want him to leave my house because I need to be there so that he is protected? We need, as families, those tools that will make sure, in one regard or another, that we can provide and be vigilant so that our sons and daughters can be a part of our communities, so that they can be productive citizens and that they can have the lives that we all want for them, as we do for any of our children. But this provides one more tool for us in that cause, in that worry, in the fact that soon my son will be joining the adult service system, and will I be able to let him leave the house each day worrying what's going to happen to him? Thank you for this opportunity. I very much appreciate it, and look forward to working with all of the legislators in the future of our children. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions of this witness? Yeah. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Marcy, just really quick, of the sexual abuse cases that you're familiar with and that you know that occurs in that environment, do you have kind of a percentage or have any idea at all how many of those become subject of a criminal investigation?
Representative Tomei and Representative Olson, I'm sorry, no, I don't have those kind of statistics, and those are things that I don't have. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
And maybe, is Bob Jundev still here? Since he brought up that statistic, right?
Yes, he did. We shared some of our statistics, as I heard
maybe
him
maybe we can ask him. Maybe you could let him know we'd be interested in that if he has that available. Thank you. Any other questions?
No, thanks, Marcy.
Thank you.
Representative Gelford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank you, Marcy, for
coming, and I think that there are many people in the world, myself included, that has a 13-year-old that can very much identify to that nagging feeling and the trust that is put into the community when these young people go out into the world to be independent. So thank you for raising
that. Thank you. And thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Okay, we have... the department is here, right? And could you come up, please? We have a few questions for you. Thank you so much for coming, and thanks for all your work on this. Representative Kotek, you had some questions.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I have several questions, and I would be fine if you say we need to go back and come back tomorrow with an answer. So, how many folks, if we go back to 5 years, which I think is the plan here for the database, how many folks would be in the database now? Do you have a sense of the number? And that's okay if that's a go back and check and come back later. But.
Yeah, let me go back and check. But actually, the Oregonian numbers are about the same because we went back, I think, six years.
Sorry. Could you identify yourself?
Thank you. Conversation. This is a hearing.
Sorry.
My name is Eva Gutash. I'm the director for the Office of Investigations and Training. And I think the information we provide to the Oregonian went back 6 years, and it's substantiated allegations of course, the whole range of things that we investigate. And so it's close to that number, but if you want the exact number, I'd like to come back with you and tell you that information.
Do you remember from the Oregonian article how many? I don't know if it's in there. But yeah, I would. I'm just trying to get a sense of
sure.
scope, because it relates to my next question, which is...
Probably about 500, I would say.
About 500?
600.
So, you know, one of the concerns we've heard is... because this is a new form of information out there for the public, would it be justified to provide some kind of process for those 500 folks to be notified and say, you're going to be online? How difficult would it be to craft a process for those folks on a one-time basis to make a case for not being included in the database, primarily because what they've done, there have been substantial remedies, substantial training, you know, maybe they go back to the very beginning of the timeline, and, you know, because of their training, they haven't, you know, been back on. I'm just wondering, would that be a difficult task? Is that something you think would be worthwhile? Because I do, you know, there is a process in the bill to take folks off, but that starts, you know,
right.
with the start of the database. So, I don't know. I'm just curious your thoughts on that. And it's not that many people.
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, certainly putting a notice out, crafting a letter and giving people an opportunity, I don't think would be that difficult. And frankly, even we have some processes already that are an informal committee process for children with developmental disabilities where we have a panel that reviews the information people provide. So I don't think that would be difficult or expensive. I think the challenge will be in finding those people. Because there's a lot, seems to be a lot of folks that work in the field, particularly on the community system, that are transitory. And I know that primarily because when we do investigations and we're trying to locate people mm-hmm. that have left employment to do an investigation, it's challenging. And we have a lot of resources to try to do that, DMV, other places that we can look. But I think that would be a good effort.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, another concern that I've heard is that we, in my mind, I think we need to go forward with this, and that we put a lot back on the rules process to clarify how this database will be implemented, what will be on there, how things will happen. How much time would you need to have a robust discussion with all the affected partners to craft those rules to a certain degree of satisfaction of all involved? I would like to see the database implemented as soon as possible, but with the understanding of you might need a couple months to do a rulemaking process, that gets to some of the things that we're asking you to do, and I'm just trying to get a sense of the time, what you think that would take.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, we are, I think we mentioned yesterday, in the process of working on the Hospital 2175, which has at the heart of it really one of these very issues, which is how you look at the egregiousness of different kinds of abuse and, you know, throughout the whole department, so not just for people with developmental disabilities. And we've had probably about 6 months of meetings internally, and we're looking to bring partners on, meaning community providers and families and others, by the end of this month. So I think there we've talked about a 4 to 6 month process to get to some agreement about that, as well as what the process might be and due process, et cetera, how the system would be formed. We're looking at other states. So I would think, I mean, if people would be give us the indulgence in that time, we could have a very good and a consistent kind of a process across the department, and not just for this population.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you have a lot in place now because of 2175. Can you build on that? Have you covered a lot of this ground, so therefore it might not take as long? And are the people who are in that discussion the right people that also should be involved in this conversation? That would be my assumption, but...
Madam Chair, Representative Kontek, yes, except for all of the partners that we need to bring in, and that's where we're, that's where we're headed in this month, is identifying and starting to invite and figuring out what kind of, how to involve everyone that wants to be involved.
Okay, thank you. And one more?
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, we've heard the discussion around more egregious cases that fit the definition of abuse, and then what are the quality care standard violations. Could you describe the difficulty in parsing those out in when you collect the information of putting the kind of information online that would make some distinction between the types of complaints? I'm not advocating one way or the other. I'm just trying to understand the difficulty involved in doing that. Because I do think the discussion that Mr. Towers raised about putting on the remedies is a helpful thing, because I think it speaks to the idea that this isn't just about accusing people of things. It's about recognizing there have been challenges. How do you get training? How do you do remedies? But in terms of distinguishing between something like a lower level financial issue versus, the rape of someone in care, how hard is that to make those distinctions and then reflect those distinctions in the database?
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, those are the discussions we've been having intensely, and I think we're looking at using certain kind of criteria, like harm to the individual, for example, is one of the elements of how you would evaluate an event or an incident that was reported and investigated, even within the same category of abuse, such as financial abuse. And other states, again, have tackled this, so we're trying to learn from, how they've set those kind of standards and what criteria they've used. So I don't know that it's so difficult. It's just working through a lot of examples and trying to have some common elements that can be understood and agreed upon, by all the parties.
One of the concerns that I've heard from many people is that there is not a standard throughout the state, that different counties have different standards. So I'm assuming that one of the things you will be working on is to standardize that, so whatever happens in Josephine County will be evaluated in the same standard as Multnomah County. Am I correct in that?
Madam Chair, absolutely, and that's one of our top uppermost goals in terms of how we work and develop the system. I think for the kind of thing that we're discussing now and how we'd evaluate it, it might be the sort of thing we do at the central office in terms of figuring out whether something rises to a certain threshold or not.
Right.
And that would improve consistency.
Terrific.
Just one brief.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This isn't an existing database per se. This would be whatever is being created for the searchable database essentially will be entered new. So you have great discretion on the level of detail you provide on there, to be completely clear about the level of the complaint and the remedies and things, unlike other databases which might just be uploaded. You're essentially creating this. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Kotev, yes, that's correct. And I think that we'd have some information there, and then we'd have more information that people could get.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This, I don't know, both of you may want to respond to this, but Representative Kotek brings up a number of good points, and it makes me ask some questions about existing information. We have existing information that under this bill would then become a database. We don't have a database. In other words, the Oregonian did their search based on freedom of information and all that, but trying to get at information that is not organized in a database. So if there's 500, in the neighborhood of 500 names of individuals, one of my questions is, how many, or do you keep information about facilities or companies or that type of thing? And do you anticipate, and maybe it's right in front of me, do you anticipate that being, those violations against those entities being part of the database?
Madam Chair and Representative Gilliam, my name is Mary Gear. I'm the Administrator for the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care in SPD, and I'd be happy to address your question. One of the initiatives that we've been working on in my office for several years and have really ramped up at Representative Merkley's request is putting an online information database that's available for search by facility, so that a family member or a consumer can go on the web and pull up the compliance information for a facility. And so we've been working very diligently on that. We're rolling that out to our partners this month and next month, and we expect to go live with information about compliance on nursing facilities, residential care facilities, and assisted living facilities probably by March. Our long-term plan is to add developmental disability, residential facilities, group homes, and then adult foster homes. And so our long-range goal then is to have one searchable database that consumers can go to and call up all the facilities in a county, for example, or a particular facility by name, and then get information about what their annual licensing inspections look like, but also what the complaint investigations look like by facility. So we're kind of talking about two different things here. This bill really is about a database that's searchable by individual employee. What I'm talking about, and I think you asked about, is something that's searchable by a particular facility. And that's one of the things that gets a little bit confusing is in some cases, it's an incident may occur because of a failure in the system that a facility has in place. Failure to train, failure to have quality assurance, failure to do criminal background checks, any number of things that can lead to potential harm or harm for a number of people in that particular setting, not just one individual.
Does that answer your... It does. I have a follow-up. It gets pretty confusing sorting out all the information because what we're trying to do is help people. I'm thinking particularly of helping individuals who are searching for an appropriate place for a loved one or family member. But when we do that, it gets pretty complicated. We've been focusing, or at least my thinking has been focusing on the individuals that were in the Oregonian article that we want to eliminate from the system, and this is a tool for that. Last night in Consumer Protection, we were talking about this same kind of thing, eliminating folks who are preying on people for... And they kept using the term bad actor, which I think you can imagine I resent. But
I can appreciate that.
We are trying to get the guys with black hats out of the scenario. But one example I want to know if you could respond to is we are talking about specifically caregiver, individual employees, abuse to... The right word is not... It's not patient, it's client or our loved one. What about when you get into this, what about client to client, resident to resident? You know, if you've got, and I've been in these facilities all my life, thank goodness my parents have sort of raised us that way, and I've been in also, and there are lots of situations, and it gets pretty complicated depending on the person's challenges or difficulties. Is that a part of this that we want to report? And is that a black eye on the individual that's monitoring those patients, or is it a black eye on the residential facility or on the company? How do we report that? Because there's a lot. I don't have figures on it, but I assume there's a lot of that kind of activity.
Chair Tomei and Representative Gilliam, there is a requirement that those types of incidents be reported and investigated. And the response to that will depend on what the situation actually was. There could be a situation where an individual who has never shown aggressive behavior before suddenly one day does. And that's different than a situation where a person with a pattern of aggressive behavior was not appropriately monitored by facility staff and hurt another resident. So again, it's that investigation piece, whether it's Adult Protective Services or OIT, to go in and look at what's the context of what actually happened in that situation. And our response and our finding will depend on that context. Does that answer your question?
It does. I just think that's one of the areas where we've got to be very careful in what we report and then ends up on a database. So that's fine.
And I just want to point out, on page 1 of the bill, section 2, number 2, the database will be searchable by the name of the facility, the name of the adult foster home provider, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah. Okay, thank you so much for coming. If you would come back tomorrow, I may not be calling you, but we may need you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we're calling Catherine White, and Marcy, I think, is back again. Marcy Alvarez, thank you. And I'm sorry that our time has diminished so quickly. Marcy, I think, did you have anything more to add, or are you just here for us to ask you questions?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I would like to testify not so much as my role yesterday on behalf of Sal's Public Policy Committee, but as a friend and a concerned citizen and a caregiver.
Marcy, I'm going to stop you for a minute because I'll need you to self-identify, but since Catherine hadn't had a chance to speak yesterday, Catherine, would you like to speak first? Thank you.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine White, and I'm with the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities. Just to be very brief, I wanted to summarize some of our major points on this bill. We are obviously in strong support of this legislation. Number one, I want to make sure that you, I want to reiterate Bob's point. This is not an employment registry. This is not a database that is a do not employ database. That is a part of the other legislation where situations of substantiated high level abuse will indicate that an individual cannot be employed. This is simply a database that will provide us with information, that will provide a broader audience with information. I want to address very quickly the issue of the vulnerability of the population we're dealing with. And the areas of substantiated abuse that meet the rape, willful harm, those levels are much clearer. But I want to address some of what we think of as the minor issues. I've spent some time doing training for individuals with disabilities on how to be more assertive, how to express themselves and have more self-determination. And in one training, one of the people that was a part of the training stopped me, and he said, "You've got to understand that the people who care for me, they've got to like me. I can't assert myself. If they don't like me, they may forget and leave me on the toilet for an extra hour. Or they may not feed me and nobody knows about it." The vulnerability of these folks, I think Judy Cuneo yesterday expressed it well. If somebody is asking them for money, they've got to have that person like them. And many of them will feel that kind of pressure. So one of the reasons that our system has developed in the way that it has, that requests reporting on even what to us may seem like minor incidents, is a reflection of the vulnerability of the people in this system who have to depend on people for their very life, their very existence. And to me, that concept that they have to be liked because their life depends on it is something that I want you to keep in mind when you think of what we think of as minor sorts of issues. This information is currently part of a public record. Providers who are in the know call OIT and ask if a name has appeared. But families who are doing hiring, and we've got to remember now because of the Staley settlement, we have thousands of families out there hiring people to provide support. They don't have the inside knowledge. They don't have a way of finding much out about the people that they're hiring. They're required to do criminal record checks, but as we've talked about it, the investigations of what are clear criminal cases is very, very low when it involves people with developmental disabilities, and DAs won't prosecute. So we don't have criminal record checks as an easy way of looking at people within the system. We've talked a lot about protective services and the investigations and what's included in it. What I see on this database, and I guess I'd ask if any of you have really spent any time looking through it, the one that was put on the Oregonian, there is a lot of information on that, and most of it really points to what Arthur talked about, training needs and training issues. It is not a no hire. It is, perhaps this is an issue that is important. So if you see someone who has five examples where they were cited on inappropriate medication management over a period of a number of years, or even a period of a couple months, that may relate to training. As a person who's looking at that, if my son is not somebody for whom medication management is a critical issue, when I talk with that person, that may not be the main issue. But if I'm hiring somebody for a child that has significant medical issues with a lot of medications, I want to know that this is a person that in the past has had some problems with medication management. I brought, and I didn't make copies because it is not part of public record for me. I don't want to put this out. But I brought you examples of protective services investigations because I want you to see that these are not done, you know, without a great deal of thought. I have a notebook of them, of protective services investigations that affect my son, that are both investigations of staff and investigations of facilities. And so I would be very happy to share that information with you at personally after this hearing. I'd be very happy to share it. So you can at least see what those investigations look like. And some of them are more serious than others. The final thing that I wanted to hit on was the urgency issue. After those articles came out, we were inundated with telephone calls from people concerned and with stories, with people who had personal experiences and stories and said, thank goodness someone is finally shedding light on what's going on and what our concerns are. There is an urgency here. We deliberately did not send out any information on this hearing because we knew this room would be overwhelmed with people concerned about this issue and wanting to have this kind of transparency available. We held a public meeting on very short notice to talk about issues that were raised by the Oregonian article. We had 65 people show up on extremely short notice. This is an urgent issue for the people in the developmental disabilities community, and we urge you to pass this legislation. Again, it's a small step on a much bigger issue, but it simply opens the door, sheds a little bit of light, and gives people a little more information on questions they need to ask about the people they're bringing into their homes and into their lives. So we urge your support and answer any questions.
Catherine, you mentioned some materials there. So you're not going to be making copies for each of the members. Is that correct? I'm not asking you to do that. I'm asking what it is you intend to do.
I would be very willing to share them with people.
Individually, is that what you're saying?
Yes, individually.
Colleagues, would you be willing to have Ms. Light meet with you individually sometime today? 5 minutes, 10 minutes?
Yeah, I mean, I'd just be very willing to share kind of what a report looks like, what's involved, what are the resolutions after that.
Does that become public information?
Yeah.
If she shared
offline? If she gives us the document...
Then if she gives us the document, but if she meets with us individually...
Not necessarily a committee document. If she hands it out here, it becomes a committee
right,
public...
Right, right, right. And that's what we don't want to do. No, but if you could meet with us individually... What's that, Representative?
I mean, if it goes in my bill folder, then it's...
Right, but we're not talking about bill folders. She's going
to... I just wanted to provide you with an example to show you what they look like. I'm sure that OIT could do a redacted versions, but we've had a lot of conversation of what these reports look like, and I don't know that you've ever really seen what goes into a report and what the findings look like. And I just wanted to make one other quick point, and that is the point that Representative Kotek made, that the database, whatever it looks like, will have to have a context to it. There will be instructions on how to use it and what it means and what it doesn't mean. I think that this is wide open for stakeholders to come together and make that design so it's useful and not harmful.
Any questions? Very quickly, yes.
Oh, okay, I'll try real quick. Thank you, Madam Chair. It's one part of your testimony that I'm confused by, and you started out by saying, make it clear we're not talking about some kind of an employment tool. And yet, it sounded like you said it still could be helpful to a group who is so sorely in need of good information in making decisions about employment. So, to me, the thing that popped in my head was, isn't it true that despite the fact that we're trying to design a database for one purpose, once it goes on the internet, we have no control over how that's used. Another one person's ceiling is another person's floor, and it could be used that way because we have no control over it. I just want to know if you could help me.
Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, yes. I think that any information helps people make decisions. It will make decisions on training. It may help provide information on whether this person is appropriate. I think that employers now go on the internet, they look at MySpace pages, they gather all sorts of information from many, many areas to help them make some decisions and have some conversations about this. These are substantiated incidents by preponderance of the evidence. So it is not as though we're putting rumor and innuendo on a database. There have been, and that's why I felt it was important to look at the investigations. There have been investigations, and these have been substantiated, remembering that the substantiation rate is about 40%. So that means that not every allegation is substantiated.
Catherine, if you could stick around today, we're hard to find, as you know.
I know.
We can't even find each other, so try to find us individually and speak with us. Thank you so much. Any other quick question?
Oh, Representative Gilliam. Go.
Thank you. So, thank you, Madam Chair. So, just to stay on this just for a second, it could be, you agree then that whether or not our purpose is one way, it could be used out of our control as an employment, a major employment tool.
Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, I think of any information that anyone gathers in any process is often used to help make decisions on whether you're going to invite somebody into your life. Right now, this information, provider organizations are getting this information by calling other providers, by calling OIT. They have ways of getting this information. So it is not that this information is not available and is not something that's used potentially in making some initial decisions. In the same way, you call the Better Business Bureau and decide whether the information is relevant, or you call the Bar Association and look at how many complaints a lawyer has had. It's information that informs wise consumer choice.
Sure. I agree.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What is our intention for the rest of the morning? We got several more?
No, we've got to be out of here because another committee is. That's why I'm trying to rush
I'm going
to
ask
through.
You a question afterwards.
You're going to ask me a question?
Yes, I am, but that's after we adjourn.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Great.
Madam Chair, right. May I testify quickly?
Oh, please do.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Marcy Alvarez, and I'm here today in a different role, and I'm very honored to be personally invited to come back and testify. I'm here as a friend, and bear with me because I'm emotional about this because it's so important. I want to share with you a time that I blew it as staff, and I messed up. I was working in a group home, and I can't tell you where, and I can't tell you with whom, but I messed up. I was a substitute staff. We all know the turnover rate is so high, and people call in sick so frequently, and the pay is so low, that I was more like a regular staff in this position. My position was a 24-and-a-half-hour shift, almost twice a week, and I forgot to give someone their medication. It was something that was supposed to be given two times a week. It was a Eucerin cream to use on their feet. They had really bad calluses. They needed it. Granted, it wasn't a life-saving medication. Had it been a seizure medication and they went into a grand mal seizure and died on my shift, it's neglectful on my behalf. Thank goodness it wasn't a life-saving medication, it was lotion. But I would be very much in support of having my name on that list if somebody died in my care. I wouldn't want to hire people who, from my loved ones or my friends, people that I care so much about, if somebody had died in their care, somebody had been raped by them or on their shift, that's really risky to me. I don't want my loved ones to be in that situation ever, or myself. And, you know, I'm not a mother. I don't have children, but I can imagine that love for someone. And it breaks my heart to hear the statistics that 83% of women with developmental disabilities are sexually abused, and almost half of the time it happens on more than 10 occasions by people they know and trust. Another situation, I walked into a room on one of my shifts and saw a coworker throwing socks at someone and said, "Here, put your socks on." To me, that was a red flag. It's intimidating. Yeah, the socks didn't hurt her or bruise her, but it wasn't a friendly, "Here, put your socks on," and a toss. It was very demeaning, and she wasn't respecting the person she was supporting as an equal, and we are equal. And so I want you to know that for the people that I love and care so much about, it's worth it. And for the Oregonian to put something online like this, that's wonderful. The state really needs to follow that, because the state oversees these group homes, oversees these adult foster homes. I wanted to share some lyrics that I heard in the car ride down this morning. We're all familiar with the song "Lean on Me," and it starts off, "Sometimes in our life we all have pain, we all have sorrow, but if we are wise, we'd understand there's always tomorrow. Tomorrow looks much brighter because we can change things. We have that authority. We have that power. You have that power. And we're looking to you to use your power to really help benefit the lives of people with developmental disabilities. Everybody deserves the right and has the right to be safe from abuse and neglect. So please do the right thing and pass House Bill 3617 so it can get to the floor. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Marcy. We really appreciate coming back. Thank you, Catherine.
Well,
did somebody have a quick question? We need to get out of here because another committee is coming. Yes.
I just wanted to thank Marcy for coming back today. Marcy's worked in my community for a long time. As we have this conversation about the few folks that have problems in the way that they care for folks, we need to remember that the vast majority of caregivers are so much like Marcy, completely dedicated to the well-being and safety and dignity and equality of the people that they work for and support. So thank you for coming and putting the face of care on the caregivers that are out there working with us.
Madam Chair and Representative Gelser, thank you.
And thanks also to the providers who are here and for people who are working for, well, I guess the unions who are representing the workers. We all know this is an extremely difficult job. And we're not here to rag on anyone. This is a Consumer Protection Act, and we appreciate the work that all of you do and the families that are here to protect their children. So we appreciate you, and we're trying to get out some good legislation that's going to be helping the people who are in these facilities and helping the facilities themselves do a better job. We're here to help. And that's going to be clear when we do pass this bill. We're going to be working with the department to make sure that all the stakeholders involved, that everybody will have feedback on how this legislation is brought forth and how it will deal with the workers and with the facilities and with the people who represent the workers. So a lot of work has been put on in here, multiple hours by so many people in this room, and we really appreciate it. We're going to come out with a good product. Thank you all so much. And with that, I'm going to carry over House Bill 3617, and we will have a possible work session Friday, tomorrow, right? So I say everything I need to say.
Yep.
Representative Gelser, you look like you want to speak.
No, I'm just listening.
Oh, great. Okay. All right. Anything for the good of the order? Thank you. Thank you for staying late. We close the House Committee on Human Services.